Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? We are continuing with the Frog Pond Art Series, Living Legends. We would like to present for you the fun and irrepressible Christine Jorgensen.
Well, hello there. Welcome to my world. Won't you come on in? Miracles, I guess. Oh, they still happen now and then. Step into my show. Leave your cares behind. Welcome to my show. Built with you in mind.
Now yes, welcome to my show. And if you're interested in transgender music, then it was indeed built with you in mind. This is Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and I think I have a special show for you this month, focusing on transgender artists and performers. Later in the show, I will feature an interview with Terry Noel, one of the performers in the early 60s from the famous Jewel Box Review, and then jump to the present to hear from Serafina Maricino, a founder of the all-transgendered rock band Lipstick Conspiracy. I opened this show with Christine Jorgensen, and many of you know that she was the first person to gain widespread attention for having sexual reassignment surgery, or SRS. Starting out as a young man from New York City, George Jorgensen Jr. left for Denmark in late 1952, and when returning in February of 1953 as Christine, she was a media sensation. For over 30 years, she was popular on the lecture circuit and known for being an author and a poised and articulate speaker. Now, I've read her very interesting autobiography and knew that she also did nightclub engagements, but until last year, I never suspected that a couple of those shows had been captured. That was done by record producer David Cunard. David grew up in England and was an actor, and early in his career, also got involved in the recording industry. In 1967, he moved to Los Angeles, and in 1975, founded AEI Records, a label devoted to musical theater and cabaret artists. Being a fan of gay musicals, I already knew this, as I have several of those recordings in my collection. I was very pleased when he contacted me last summer, having seen my extensive coverage on my site of Christine Jorgensen, and he told me that he was getting ready a recording of her nightclub show. Of course, I was fascinated. And that project was completed and uploaded to iTunes in December. I thought it would be interesting to hear how this project came about and interview David. But before we get to that, let's hear just a snippet of Christine in her show. It's a show of music, stories, and impressions, and here's her intro to a very logical song choice.
But I'm so glad to be here, and it's really grand here in the LA area, and wonderful audiences. Now, none of you were aware that I was a singer, right? Well, let me tell you, when she heard me sing, Beverly Sills told me it made her very, very nervous. I believe that this is an era or a place where one should be having a wonderful time. Put your troubles outside. Believe me, they'll be waiting for you there when you get out there to meet them. But I always think the nightclub should be fun. We don't have to be the greatest performers. I'm not the greatest performer in the world at all. But it's fun. And if you have a good time and I have a good time, then we've all had a good time together. And I think that's what life is all about. But you know, many years ago, when I was playing at the Latin Quarter in New York, a beautiful show opened on Broadway. It was called Flower Drum Song. In it, Pat Suzuki sang this wonderful tune, which became my theme song. See if you remember it. I'm a girl, and by me that's only great. I am proud that my silhouette is curvy, that I walk with a sweet and girlish gait, with my hips kind of swivelly and swervy. I adore being dressed in something frilly. When my date comes to get me at my place, out I go with my Joe or John or Billy.
like a filly who is ready for the race. And I have a brand new hairdo with my eyelashes all in curl. I float as those clouds on air do. I enjoy being a girl. When men say I'm cute and funny, and my teeth aren't teeth but pearls, I just lap it up like honey. I enjoy being a girl.
Very appropriately, that was a bit of I Enjoy Being a Girl. And let's hear now from David Cunard how the recording came about. Tell me about the project to make Christine's cabaret show available.
In 1985, there were a number of cabaret ladies playing around Los Angeles, one of whom was Vivian Blaine. And Miss Blaine was the first celebrity of any kind to do public service announcements for AIDS, so APLA. And I ran a small label called AEI, and it was thought it would be a nice idea to record some of these ladies. Vivian Blaine was one. And then I saw that Christine was going to be appearing at what was then Studio One, a discotheque in what is now West Hollywood. And I don't recall exactly how I contacted her, but anyway, I did. And she was delighted at the idea that it would be recorded. And so we set up the recording equipment and recorded two evenings. And that's how it started. And then after that, we re-recorded it at a restaurant called the Frog Pond. And that was right in the heart of Silver Lake, which is a predominantly gay area. And Chris did a couple of shows there, and we recorded those. And that's what you hear on the tape.
And how did you get interested in recording Christine?
Well, I suppose just the fact that she was a novelty. Small labels like my own thrived on unusual projects. AEI was the first company to ever release London cast recordings in the United States. And there's a young man whose name is Alan Eichler, who represented a number of older ladies who had, you know, maybe just passed their prime in stardom. And he initially had brought Vivian Blaine to me. So there was a little circuit. And, of course, knowing who Christine was and that she was doing her show out here just seemed to be an obvious choice.
How did her show go over?
At the Frog Pond, it went over very, very well. And that was the second time. This Studio One, and I doubt if you or your listeners have ever been there, they had a small theater there. Well, I say small by comparison to a regular theater, but it was very big for a cabaret space, and it wasn't really intimate enough, and some of her material fell rather flat, I'm afraid, and it wasn't particularly well rehearsed. She, of course, had been doing a lot of material on the lecture circuit, talking about sexuality, transgenderism, and so on, and she'd been away from the cabaret stage for some time. So this was a sort of way, in a way, a comeback for her. Not that she'd ever been away, but a comeback in terms of cabaret. And maybe some of her material was just a bit old-fashioned for what was a very young group at a discotheque. But at the restaurant, at the Frog Pond, which is a much smaller, intimate space, that was very successful, and they loved her.
For such a specialty niche market, it can be cost prohibitive to release CDs. So what was your approach to the marketing?
When iTunes came along, I approached them initially. They weren't interested in independence to start with. But 18 months ago, they said, yes, we would be interested, and uploaded some of the material. I think it's about 25 or 30 albums, including Christine's, on iTunes.
What other gay-related recordings have you uploaded to iTunes?
Boy Meets Boy, of course. Joseph McCarthy is alive and living in Dade County.
Charles Pierce?
Oh, pardon me, Charles Pierce, yes. That's thank you for reminding me. Didn't come to mind because I didn't actually produce it, but a friend of mine did, and he had the label Wanda Records.
Any plans for additional recordings?
Well, with regard to Christine, she did do an interesting part, which I had not considered 20-plus years ago. towards the end of her show, after doing the singing and everything else, a few jokes, and she did a lot of quick changes as well, which is very clever. She did a question and answer sequence, which apparently she had perfected in her lectures to students when she was lecturing on sexuality. And she learned to deal with all kinds of people. And she said, well, even though there's alcohol being served, she would do it because she knew that she could handle any questions which were maybe not so proper. And that's a very interesting part of what she did, was to answer questions about how she felt about gay life and so on. She actually wasn't, I can't say that she was in the forefront of gay rights at all. She had very ambivalent feelings about gay men. I mean, she was surrounded by them. And this is a whole generation ago.
Well, hopefully David will proceed with the project for the interview recording. I'd love to hear it. But you can find the nightclub recording on iTunes. It's called Christine Jorgensen, I Enjoy Being a Girl, An Evening of Songs and Laughter. Before we leave this segment, here's just a little more of it. This time she's doing an impression of Marlene Dietrich.
I see what the boys in the back room will have, and tell them I'm having to say. I'll see what the boys in the back room will have, and tell them I cried, and tell them I sighed, and tell them I died of the same. And when I die, don't send me flowers or rotten pictures in a frame. No, see what the boys in the back room will have, and tell them I cried, and tell them I sighed, and tell them I died of the same.
Christine Jorgensen had her sex change in 1952, and for my next guest, that process started in 1965. That story is very interesting, but also is her earlier history. Her name is Terry Noel, and she was a performer in the famous Jewel Box Revue and also at the 82 Club in New York City. She was therefore a professional female impersonator. A note about the Jewel Box Revue. Before Stonewall, there were a number of well-known drag clubs, such as Finocchio's in San Francisco, the Club My Oh My in New Orleans, and the 82 Club in New York. But there was really only one touring company of female impersonators that became famous, and that was the Jewel Box Revue. It started in 1939 at a club in Miami, and in the early 1940s started touring the country, billed as 25 Men and a Girl. The company lasted until 1975, although there have been others since then using that name. I was delighted last year when one of the Jewel Box Revue performers, Terry Noel, contacted me, and we've been corresponding ever since. I simply could not pass up getting her story captured for this show. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in a small town in Kentucky, and actually it's a good thing because I wasn't mistreated, you know, by the folks who lived there. A lot of people I hear about were mistreated in their youth, and I wasn't. So I was lucky.
Tell me about your start as a female impersonator.
In 1958, I won a drag contest at a local bar where I was hanging out. First time I'd ever done any such thing as that. And somebody handed me a magazine that had the address of the Jewel Box Revue in New York. And so I wrote to them on a lark and sent them pictures. And then they called me like 2 weeks later and asked me to join the show. So I joined the show in Asbury Park, New Jersey, early in 1959. And I was with them for, oh, I guess 15 months until I landed in New York City. I really hated the road because the Jewel Box Revue was a traveling show.
Did you have the name Terry Noel then?
Or mm-hmm.
Is that your real name? Your
no.
Stage name?
It's my stage name.
How did you pick that name?
Well, Terry is my actual middle name, and it was my mother's maiden name. Noel was taken from a guy I used to know who was French-Canadian. And his name was Noel, so I just took that.
Human nature being what it is, people are going to be curious about your age. Do you mind sharing that?
No, I'll be 71 at the end of this summer.
And what was your performing experience up to the point where you joined the Jewel Box Review?
Absolutely nothing. I had never performed anything except piano, because I played piano all my life, but I never performed, you know, if you're asking about performing in nightclubs or anything, nothing like that. I played for church, and I played for, you know, various activities at school and so on, but nothing that you could call a professional performance, no.
That's kind of amazing that they hired you.
Well, I wasn't hired as a performer. I was hired as window dressing. I was hired as a showgirl, and all you have to do is stand there and sing and parade around, you know, and participate in the production numbers and so on, you know. So it was an easy gig, really.
What were some of the more famous venues at which you performed?
Oh, my gosh. Here we go. We performed... You're talking about the Jewel Box Review, right? We performed in a lot of supper clubs, and we performed in regular theater houses, and we also performed in big movie houses. And in that situation, we would go in, start getting ready, they would show a film, and then after the film was over, we would do a show. And it went on like that, film, show, into the evening, you know. And in the supper clubs, they would, you know, serve dinner to a bunch of guests, and we would do a show while they were eating. And like that, you know. And in the theaters, we would just do like two a day, something like that. It was fun, but boy, the travel will just wear you down to a nub.
I understand one of the venues was the Apollo Theater.
Boy, yes, that was a great experience. We were there for a long time, maybe 6 or 7 weeks in one summer, and those folks were so nice to us. I tell you, they were great people, and they enjoyed us. We did have some protesting going on outside when we first opened, you know, big signs and things, but that didn't last but a couple of days, and then we got into our regular routine.
What did you do in the JBR? What kind of act did you have?
In the JBR, I was a showgirl, like I said, and... It was centered around production numbers, actually. We had some acts, some singing and dancing and so on, acts, and they did that, and then we would do production numbers as well. And I was one of the showgirls, just in the background, like. And then when we were in New York, in Brooklyn, at Maxix, which was the most beautiful club we ever played, we formed a singing trio, and I was one of the girls who sang, so we had great fun doing that.
What type of songs did you sing? Do you remember?
With the trio, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I can't remember. Mostly up-tempo things, you know, sort of a la Andrew Sisters things.
Things that would be popular on the radio?
Yeah, but, you know, not rock and roll or anything like that. It was standards, mostly, yeah.
How did you move from the JBR to the 82 Club?
I got really tired of the travel, like I said. Living out of a suitcase and traveling on a bus all over the country. And when we played New York at Maxix, someone introduced me to Kit Russell, who was the director of the 82. And I happened to have a photo from the Jewel Box Review, which showed me in a scene with the male dancers, where I was sitting on their knees and so on. And it reminded her of herself, Kit Russell. And so she asked me to join the show, and boy, was I glad to do so.
Who are some of the famous female impersonators you work with?
Whoa. Lynn Carter was the headliner in the Jewel Box. She was the main person. Robbie Ross was a fine performer who performed in the Jewel Box as well. Billy Day, who did an impersonation of Billie Holiday and was really popular at the Apollo, you can imagine. Gosh, there were so many. I'm trying not to leave out anybody, but... Now, memory fades, actually. It was 40-what years ago.
Did you work with Ty Bennett?
Well, that was at the 82. Now, if you're going to talk about the 82, it was Ty Bennett. Kim August, I don't know if you've heard of Kim August. She was a fantastic singer. And that was about it so far as headliners were concerned at the 82. It's a pretty stable show. People didn't go, you know, didn't leave and come and go much there. because it was a solid venue and it was very popular then. And, you know, it was easy to live there and work there in New York.
The people I'm most familiar with, because they had recordings, were Lynn Carter and Ty Bennett. Do you have any special memories of them?
Well, Ty was a very private person and very personable, you know, and funny as the devil on stage. And Kim, of course, was my dear friend. I just loved her to death. She used to sing Little Girl Blue for me when it would get late at night, you know, and she would perform that song for me because I loved it so. But she was quite a singer. I really appreciated her talent. Ty was more or less a sort of reminded you of Sophie Tucker, you know, way back, who did a lot of patter and was very good at it. He was very good at his craft. And then, of course, Jackie Mayo was also in the show. Have you heard of Jackie May?
Yes.
Yeah. She sang and did very well and was quite good at her craft, too, because she'd been around for a very long time. Even then, she'd already been around for years and years.
Any special memories of Lynn Carter?
Oh, Lynn was a hoot. Yeah, she was very kind to me. I know that. And she impersonated Pearl Bailey, as I recall. And then she also did a flapper number with Robbie Ross where they were, you know, came out doing the Charleston and so on. She was very, very talented. She did other impersonations, too. I believe she did a Josephine Baker impersonation, too, and Bette Davis. She did a lot of real impersonations of stars.
Okay, we're going to take a music break, so I found an appropriate song. It's by an English actress and comedian named Hermione Baddeley. She starred in movies such as Room at the Top and Mary Poppins, but was more known for her role as Mrs. Naugatuck on the TV show Maude. In her stage appearance, she sang many comedy songs, such as the one I'm playing from her 1961 album, A Taste of Hermione Baddeley.
I changed my sex a week ago today. I don't know what the dressmaker will say. For whichever way it was, she'll have to alter it because my underpants were cut a different way. I changed my sex just 7 days ago. I don't quite know how much it's going to show. It's all the same to me, whether I'm a he or she, but my friend is very curious to know. I suppose I ought to notify Her Majesty's officials that my passport may be open to some doubt. For although I haven't changed my name or altered my initials, my particulars have now gone down the spout. If I'm forced into the army, I shall have to change my plans to conform with such demands as may be made. For it might not be so easy to explain just what I am when I'm standing to attention on parade. Yes, just 7 days ago it came to light. I don't think it will matter, but it might. I'm bewildered, I confess, by the rumors in the press that Christine intends to have it out tonight.
Again, Hermione Baddeley and I Changed My Sex a Week Ago Today. Back to the interview with Terry Noel. Of the folks you work with at the 82 Club and JBR, what percent of them would you say were gay?
I would say 98%. Of course, sure. There were a couple who were not, who were just impersonating for the money, you know, just and went home to their wives and so on. But, oh, most of them, I would say, were gay.
Mm-hmm. And what percent were transgendered?
See, there were no people transgendered in the Jewel Box in the late 59 and early 60 that I was aware of. At the 82, there were, I guess, maybe three tops. Because actually, it was a fairly new phenomenon then, you know, and people kind of looked down on it, actually, you know, like mutilation of yourself and so on.
Also, I wondered if the venues would have considered transgendered performers as a kind of a contradiction of the illusion.
They might have, but those who were going, who were taking hormones and things sort of hid it. You know, it was just, it was common knowledge, but not to the management. Because the management was very strict on us at the 82 Club. You know, there was no leaving the club in drag or anything. It was, if you did that, you'd just kiss your job goodbye. Except on New Year's Eve.
And why did they do that?
Why did they do that? Well, because there were laws about it. And even though, you know, the club was managing the police pretty well, we just couldn't slap them in the face like that, you know. But on New Year's Eve, somehow we would be able to get away with it.
Did you experience any police harassment or problems?
No, never. There was a time, though, there toward the end, where I was already in the process of my transition, my SRS, where I came home at 4 o'clock, like we always did from the Club 82, and I got out of a cab, and I ran up my steps, and a police car stopped, and two cops got out and chased me up the steps until I told them that I worked at the 82 Club, and I was coming home from work, that's all. And then they just let me go.
Describe a typical JBR show.
Oh, well, it would start out with a production number where we were sort of presented ourselves to the audience. And then there would be a couple of acts, and then we would do another production number, maybe a couple of acts, and we'd do a finale. It was about a two-hour show, maybe a little over, maybe 2 hours each time. I don't know exactly what you want to know.
Was it their original music or songs of the day? Or
we took music from, for instance, we did a number called American in Paris, and we used Gershwin's music for that. The people who did their own acts, now they did the standards of the day and so on in their acts. But the production number were mostly things that had been done, you know, before and were maybe taken from a Broadway show or something.
And it was all real singing.
Oh, yeah. We had a band every time. We never lip-synced anything. Nothing was lip-synced. Nothing was recorded. We always had a live band, even at the 82. And we would have a house band at every theater we went to.
Okay, what was it like to be at 82 and JBR Girl? Was it fun? Was it strictly work, showbiz?
Well, the JBR was a traveling show, as I said, and we would rehearse sometimes during the day, but we would also have downtime. And it was during the downtime that we would, like, create new shows from scratch. And then we would, I mean, we were always working either in the daytime or performing, one or the other. At the 82 Club, we were constantly rehearsing, and the schedule was really a killer because we would have our shows until 4 a.m., and our rehearsals would start like at 10 a.m., and we would have to be at some rehearsal hall somewhere to create new numbers. So that was really hard. That was the hardest of all. We would have long periods where we would not be creating a new show, you know, but in general, we were rehearsing a great deal for the 82 Club and working at night all the while.
Sounds exhausting.
Oh, it was. My God. And we did 18 shows a week at the 82 Club for $65 a week. We supplied our own makeup, our own hair, our own undergarments, our own stockings. They supplied the heels and the costumes. So on $65, we also had to supply all those things.
I understand that many celebrities would come to the 82 Club and that you even dated one of them. Could you tell us about that?
Oh, well, yeah. Jim Hutton, I dated about 4 or 5 times. That's all. That's all. But a lot of celebrities came, for sure. You know, do you want me to name them?
Sure.
Well, there was Judy, of course, Judy Garland, and Liz Taylor, Richard Burton, Warren Beatty, Natalie Wood, Lorne Greene. Also met Eddie Arnold, who I was privilege to spend some time with. Oh, gosh. And some, not many Broadway people, but Bernadette Peters, Carol Channing. I'm trying to think. There must have been more, but, you know, it's been a long time.
The music that you've been hearing in the background throughout this interview is Terry on piano, and I'm pleased that she sent me a recording of her playing and singing. Here is her doing the song, Lies of Handsome Men.
I believe in star signs, and I believe in film romances. I believe in fantasy, and I believe with just one glance he's crazy for my eyes. 'Cause I believe the lies of handsome men. I believe in witchcraft, and I believe in Cinderella. I believe in gypsies, and I believe I cast a spell that sends him to the skies. 'Cause I believe the lies of handsome men. Somewhere in a corner of my mind, I'm not a fool, completely blind. But even though he's hooked me on his line, I find the pleasure's been mine. I believe in love songs. They seem to know just what I'm feeling. I believe Prince Charming. I never guess he's double dealing. How my spirits rise, believing in the lies of handsome men. Sometimes in a darkened place, the truth and I meet face to face. And even if His Highness disappears, I keep some stunning souvenirs. So I believe in heroes. I expect that happy ending, wishing on some rainbow. I pretend he's not pretending. Someday I'll get wise. But right now, I need the lies of handsome men.
Again, that was Terry Noel. Do you do much performing these days?
No, I have a little talent on the piano, and I play around at some retirement homes here. You know, captive audiences, so they can't get away until I'm through. And I sing a little bit, and I don't know. It has to be a captive audience.
How many were in the cast of the JBR?
Well, it's advertised as 25 men and a girl.
With that many female impersonators, was there competition or was it a family affair?
It was pretty much easy go because we were all under the same stress, you know. It was just get the job done, you know.
So you joined the JBR in 59?
Mm-hmm.
And stayed with them how long?
About 15 months, I would say, and then joined the 82 Club.
And how long did you work for that?
Until 1966. I had my SRS surgery in September of 65, and I stayed with the show. They were kind enough to let me do that until I found an office job, which was in February of 66, and then I left the show for good.
Did you say, okay, I'm going to get my surgery and then leave show business? What was your plan?
They didn't want me in the show after I had the surgery. But it was my plan to leave anyway, because I didn't want to be in the show after my surgery, actually. I wanted to get a regular life, you know, fade into society. And that's what I did.
At what age did you realize you wanted to be a woman?
I can't ever remember a time when I didn't want to be female, even when I was a little kid. And then when I was about 12, I guess, 11, 12, something like that, I was in the restroom getting some water to wash the green boards in my school for my teacher. And Mr. Morgan, our basketball coach, walked out of the shower totally nude. He was the first adult male I'd ever seen nude. And I've never been the same since. And it just sort of progressed beyond that. I tried very hard to be a gay man. I really did when I learned the facts of life. Tried hard, you know, but here's the thing. I never could sleep with a gay man. The instant a gay man showed interest in my male anatomy, it was like somebody turned off the lights. I wasn't interested. I wanted a regular Joe, and I wanted to be treated like a female. I have a lot of gay friends, and I adore being with them. But when it comes to, you know, down to the nitty-gritty, I want a regular Joe.
When you moved to New York and joined JBR, did you also start living as a woman?
No, it took me 3 years to make the decision to have the surgery. No, I didn't think about it for the first couple of years until there were a couple of people that I knew were having hormones, getting hormone injections and so on, with a famous doctor there who did that sort of thing. And it just sort of seemed like what I should do because of the way I wanted to live my life, you know?
I understand, and I think this is fascinating, that your mother took out a loan to help pay for your surgery and arranged for your birth certificate to be changed.
God bless her. She certainly did. she went to, I don't know, one of those, you know, storefront loan places, and got me some money because I was coming up short on the price, you know, because when I had my very first surgery, it was illegal to do in the States at that time. So what I had to do was pay the hospital administrators under the table to allow the surgery to occur. So it took some money, you know, and I didn't have two dimes to rub together, actually. And on $65 a week, you can imagine. And so she did go and get a loan and help me pay for it. Yeah, and then after it was over, the doctor wrote me some papers, and I saw a psychiatrist for about 10 minutes, and he wrote me a paper, too. And my mom took them down to the county clerk and put them on the table, and within a week or so, I had an official birth certificate with no addendums to it, so that there's nothing on there to say that I am transgendered. Now, I know people who are struggling to get something like that. I never had to go to court or anything. They just did it for her.
Yeah, I was going to say, I had the impression it was much more difficult.
Oh, yeah.
If even possible.
Some places it is impossible and will always be impossible.
How did you transition from being a showgirl to an office girl?
Well, I had already been trained in office procedure before I'd ever joined the Jewel Box Review. And I already had office skills. And I knew I could get a job. I really did know that. That's the one area where I was most confident in all that.
And office work became your career?
Oh, yeah. I worked in several places around New York. I worked in Rockefeller Center. I worked on Wall Street. I worked a lot of places, and then I left New York in 1969. I had another surgery in 68, which was the real surgery that made everything right for me as a woman. And then I left in 69 and moved south.
and you moved from New York City to Virginia Beach and got married.
Yeah, I did. I went to Virginia Beach, and I met a very nice man there. And we were together for 14 years, and we were married. We lived together 3 years first, and then we were married, and he brought his son to live with us from his first marriage. The son was in Europe, so we brought him over and had our little family there until 85 when we were divorced. And my husband never knew my past. He never knew that I had been a male. He still doesn't know, and neither does my stepson. Now, I don't know if that's of any importance or not, but it seems to freak people out, and it's interesting, I think, to them.
I have the impression that you've lived totally as a woman most of your life, and now you're being more public about your story. What are your thoughts on sort of coming out of that closet?
Well, here's the thing. I've reached an age where I don't want to be totally exposed. I'm going to be in semi-stealth the rest of my life. But I guess I have something to share, you know. And that's what I'm trying to do, just a little bit, you know. Just let people know that you can have a long and successful life after surgery. And you don't have to be in showbiz to do it. That's really what I'm trying to do. You know, I have no visions of grandeur here about anything concerning me. I just want people to know that you can live a good life.
Do you have any message you would like to get across to my listeners?
I don't know. Things are so open now, you know, and people don't have to hide themselves, and don't have to be ashamed of who you are like I was, and so miserable with it all, and I don't think I have any message for them. I mean, any information you want is on the internet. You don't have to, you know, do like I did and do everything by yourself. You can get information and proceed to wherever it is that you want to go.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more Very Queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. Up next, Lipstick Conspiracy.